Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cactus Cafe. Woo! Look at that. I know. So beautiful. What a beautiful night. And it's lovely to have everybody here tonight. So thank you for coming. I'd like to start this evening with a quote. Some of you may know it. And if you do, I'm very impressed. It's out of one of my favorite books, which was published in 1967, as we will learn this evening, a very interesting year. And it is, "Things have a life of their own. It's simply a matter of waking up their souls." Anyone? No. It's from 100 Years of Solitude. And I love that book. And thinking about this second quintet, I was also thinking a lot about the work of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and the parallels to the future and the present and the absence of time that both of these things share. Miles Davis and his idea of music, also the second quintet, and 100 Years of Solitude. So I wanted to start off with that. I know you didn't know I was going to do that. And before, you know, I should probably introduce you. I just keep like referring to you. So here with me to talk about Miles Davis and the art of the future this evening, rabbi and jazz historian and jazz musician as well, Rabbi Neil Blumhoff. Welcome. What do you think?
So one more time with that quote so we can all hear it and dwell on it.
Well, I'll read the whole thing out of the book then.
No.
People might know it then. "Things have a life of their own," the gypsy proclaimed with a harsh accent. "It's simply a matter of waking up their souls."
Great. Thank you for coming, everybody. That was, sounds amazing. It's there's a sense of ESP with that. So we're very glad that you're here, and we're going to have some conversations about waking up our souls and recognizing what is still asleep. And we're going to have just a beautiful conversation with some superlative musicians who are here, who are going to interpret not only what has been, but what will yet be with their own beautiful musicianship as well. So we're going to just think about Miles Davis, who is really an icon in music, in culture. And he actually had a very interesting idea about sort of putting his life together with what is and what has been. But he says that it's important for him to have style. And style itself is, he says, "For me, music and life are all about style." And we're going to just think about and anticipate and contribute to the developments in jazz of 50 years. So when we do that, we're going to see that his life, it doesn't come out of ex nihilo. It doesn't come out of just nothing. It comes out of some of the great developments that he's had since the 40s when he started with Charlie Parker. And also in his first quintet and sextet that released Kind of Blue in 1959, and in addition to the harsh treatment that he had, actually, in the same year in 1959, when he was standing outside Birdland, and he was escorting someone to her car, and the policeman said, "Move on." And he said, "You know, actually, that's my name, and I'm actually here. This is my gig." And he was assaulted and beaten, and he themselves, then charges were brought against him, and he was later acquitted for disorderly conduct and third-degree assault. But he wrote about it in his autobiography, and he said in 1959, "This incident changed my whole life and whole attitude again, made me feel bitter and cynical again when I was starting to feel good about the things that had changed in this country." So we find him in the beginning of the 60s sort of drifting a little bit. John Coltrane left his sextet. Cannonball Adderley left and began to develop their beautiful careers as well. And we find him in the early 60s trying to figure out with some of the folks who were still with him in Kind of Blue. And he's sort of rehearsing these standards. These did a lot of sort of Broadway hits. And then what happened in 1963, 64 is that this gelling of young talent, young hungry talent, came and transformed his life as much as he transformed theirs.
You know, but what that incident speaks to, which I think is continuous throughout the legacy of Miles Davis, is this disconnection that he has as an individual from what he created and what he is continuing to create. And I heard this great story about when he was at a state dinner, which I'm sure you know, which a lot of people probably know, but it was later on in his career, and he sat down next to a woman, and she said, "Oh, and why are you here?" And he said, "Well, I've changed music over 5 times." And he said, "Why are you here?" I didn't use the adjectives, but or expletives, but you know, they had that exchange, and it just, it resonates with the fact that he was a little bit always aside from this magnitude of change that he was a part of and that he created.
Absolutely. And he said, "I know what I've done for music, but don't call me a legend. Just call me Miles Davis." So this opportunity of recognizing what you have and not sort of standing still and saying, "Look what I did. Where's my recognition?" Although perhaps he did feel that he wasn't recognized for who he was, he did certainly change music, not only jazz music, but certainly rock as well, with, as we'll see, as this second quintet continues into 1968.
So before the first tune, let's just talk a little bit about the logistics of how he formed this quintet. How did everyone kind of get together?
So I just want to introduce the quintet themselves. So there was on saxophone was Wayne Shorter. And Wayne Shorter was, before he joined Miles Davis, he was actually the musical director for Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. And he joined after a whole host of saxophone players like Sonny Stitt, Hank Mobley, George Coleman, Sam Rivers. And he was the last to join this quintet. And he brought this amazing curiosity and compositional fervor. On piano was Herbie Hancock, who was classically trained. And when he was 11 years old, he performed the first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 26 with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So, you know, that's Herbie Hancock. And
anyone see him when he was recently here with Wayne Shorter? Nice.
Yeah, it was a holiday. I couldn't make it. It was. It was Passover. What can I do? It's sad. You know, you only change the world a little bit. Herbie Hancock was actually introduced to Miles Davis by the wunderkind drummer, Tony Williams. Tony Williams joined Miles Davis when he was 17 years old. And Miles wrote about Tony. He said, "Williams was the center the group's sound revolved around." And he was there, and he was a very important part. And also on bass was Ron Carter, who is the second most recorded jazz bassist in music, and he joined Miles Davis in 1963. So he had sort of, as I said, these sort of remnants he had. The first song we're going to play is a standard that comes off an album of 1961. It's called "Someday My Prince May Come," and it features, it's weird, it actually features Hank Mobley on the melody, but the solo was actually taken on the album by John Coltrane. So it sort of shows the sort of abstraction and sort of ambiguity of who's in and who's out. And I think with these four other players, the quintet began in 1964 with the release of their first songs together on an album called ESP. That was that I think had a lot to say about what kind of mind meld they had together also. So I think we wanted to actually feature what was in 1961. I wouldn't say that it was a drifting sense of things, but I would say that Miles Davis, I don't have to say it. Some musicologists say that Miles Davis in 1961 was in a rut. He was in a rut. And these wonderful young musicians helped save him, and the compositions that we'll hear throughout tonight are actually all by Wayne Shorter, with the exception of the last one. So Wayne Shorter sort of pushed him. And when we talk about the future, we're not just talking about setting up our success of our students. We're actually talking about our preservation as teachers of how we engage in the world also.
Never let a crisis go to waste. That's what I always say.
Do you say that?
I do. I always
is that
say
you?
That.
I thought that was Lorca. So, just joking.
You stole it.
Right.
So
I think we're going to do a little music.
That would be wonderful.
Here's a cool thing by Confucius, though. I'm just going outside.
He and I also have a lot in common. So. Go ahead. So
he's just in terms of like how, what is our legacy? Like, what are we going to be remembered for? And Miles Davis wanted to be Miles Davis. Confucius said, if you think in terms of a year, plant a seed. If in terms of 10 years, plant trees. But if you think in terms of 100 years, teach the people. And I think that that's what was going to be happening spontaneously with this beautiful group of five men who really learned and loved and could read each other's musical thoughts. So you ready for a little music? Beautiful. So we're going to hear two songs. The first, again, is from 1961. It's called Someday My Prince Will Come. Anybody know where it's from? Disney, 1937. Snow White. Cool. Frank Churchill. Yes, indeed. It's a princess. So do you know the first jazz rendition of Someday My Prince Will Come? It was performed by the Ghetto Swingers in the Theresienstadt concentration camp in 1943. So it's quite interesting. We can do a Jews and Brews on that. But, you know, this is a... So... You know, what are you going to do? And then,
they've been saying it all along, so it's nothing.
And then the second tune we'll hear is ESP, which is off the album called ESP, recorded in the beginning of 1965. New compositions from various members, Ron Carter and Wayne Shorter. And it featured, I wanted to put these two together because Someday My Prince Will Come as sort of a tight sort of, you'll hear it and you're like, oh, Miles Davis, it's so romantic, it's so beautiful. And then ESP is more of like an abstract, empathetic, extrasensory, perceptive quality of the musicians and their interaction. And I want you to listen to our pianist who's new to our Views and Brews jazz series, Ben Irem. I want you to listen to his channeling Herbie and his piano comping behind the wonderful musicians. So let us introduce on drums, Brannon Temple. On bass, Roscoe Beck. On saxophone from Dallas, Texas, Shelley Carroll. Shelley just finished touring with the Ellington Orchestra, and he was just in Israel, which was really nice. Shelley, how was it? Was it nice?
Yes.
Beautiful. And on trumpet, David Young. David and I, we were from the Chicago area, and he knows the band director from my high school. He obviously made something of his life. David Young did. and on piano, introducing Ben Irem. So two tunes, Someday My Prince Will Come and ESP. Thank you.
Thank you.
So as we move into the first tune for the second great quintet, I want us to hear how Philly Joe Jones, who would have played that song, moves into Tony Williams. I want you to hear the differences in drumming. And Jimmy Cobb, who becomes Ron Carter on the bass. And also that was Wynton Kelly, who would have played, and now, of course, Herbie Hancock. So I want you to hear, just 3 years later, the differences, and of course, that would have been Hank Mobley and John Coltrane, now Wayne Shorter, and as we enter into the first quintet, and aptly named ESP. David Young on trumpet. Shelley Carroll, saxophone. Ben Irem, piano. Roscoe Beck, bass. Brandon Temple, drums.
We are lucky people here in Austin. That's fantastic. Once again for the incredible band. You know, before we go into conversation, I was thinking about a friend of mine called when he found out we were doing this show. And he said, I've got a great story about Miles Davis I have to tell you. And I said, okay, fantastic. This is a new friend. And if you don't know him, he runs the New York Public Library and has fantastic podcasts. His name's Paul Holdengraber. And he knew a photographer of Miles Davis. And he said that the photographer told him this story when Miles was playing at Carnegie Hall. And it was completely sold out within 2 minutes. And the photographer asked Miles, and he said, would you happen to have any extra tickets? I have a friend who really, really wants to see you. And it's not that meaningful. You know, I've seen you 1,000 times, but he really, really would like to see you. Is there any way that you can let him in? He said, yeah, I'll have 2 tickets at the door. Like, no problem. He said, is there anything else your friend would like? And he said, he loves My Funny Valentine. And Miles turned around and he said, have him buy the record. And I mean, that's such a beautiful story, and there's so much you can take away from that. But one thing that I think it really speaks to is the way that Miles had such reverence and gratitude for his entire band, and knew it wasn't just about him and the nostalgia and everything that he brought along with him, but it was about what was going to be created in the moment with the entire band. And I think that's really beautiful, and listening to everyone play together this evening and recreate this sound, it's apparent how important and integral every single person is to what is being created at that time.
I think so. And Miles said, I'm always thinking about creating. My future starts when I wake up every morning. Every day I find something creative to do with my life. So I think being asked to do something as he continued to develop, I think that was his genius, is that he never stood still, and that he had the opportunity to really find a new way each time. And the progression, if you really look at his life, is quite extraordinary. It's a little bit wordy, but you know, he started with Charlie Parker and the birth of the cool, in cool jazz in the 40s. In the 50s, he explored hard bop as he was struggling with his own drug addiction and the treatment of black musicians. He picked up the moniker at that point, Prince of Darkness. He was sort of rediscovered and sort of re-brought out into the media and the cultural iconic status after the 1955 Newport Jazz Festival. Then he started collaborating with Gil Evans on orchestral collaborations, and Bill Evans, of course, who we've explored here before. Anybody remember that one? Yeah. That was a good one. The modal jazz style, etc. And then in 1960s, nobody really knows what this is, the intersection of free jazz or what the critics call post-bop. And then in the 70s, he experimented with rock and funk and electronic music. And in the 1980s, he took pop music. He interpreted Cyndi Lauper, Michael Jackson. And you know, his critics said, really, Miles? And he said, in the 80s, this music, Cyndi Lauper, Michael Jackson, is what was the Broadway shows of the 30s and the 40s. So what I've been doing is of just expanding the repertoire of American music. And he actually set the tone for not only jazz musicians, but also wonderful artists like Prince, may his memory be a blessing, who was directly influenced by Miles Davis. So for him to say, by the record, I understand that. I get it, of saying, that's not who I am anymore. You caught me in a picture in which I once was, but that me doesn't exist anymore.
And also, you know, when I was thinking about this show, I was thinking a lot about what his music did for the future of music. But you said, no, 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 let's talk about Miles as a leader. And it's really fascinating to me to, there's a story about an interaction he had with Ron Carter where he said, you know, he was playing and he said, you know, play behind me like you play behind everybody else. Like, why aren't you, you know, really bringing it? And Ron was like, for real? Okay. Like, we will. And it made me think about this idea of what, you know, this reverence that people have for leaders and how he had to humble himself as a leader and say, no, like, don't treat me like that. I am part of this group too. And that's really difficult, I think, for a lot of leaders to do, is to come down and say, no, I have to be a part of this in order for it to happen.
I agree. And I think perhaps the best way of demonstrating leadership is to get out of your own way and to allow what you have taught and what you have modeled to actually happen organically. And I think Miles, in all of his career, was able to do that in a beautiful way. You know, the myth-making that we have of Miles Davis is really an artificial thing for us to say, oh man, yeah, Miles, I love Miles. Well, which Miles are you talking about? And I think that his development really parallels America's quest to define ourselves as well. And I think his extraordinary career, and his troubled career, really, a lot of things changed for him in 1966, 1967, when he really turned 40 years old. You guys, nobody? You guys will get there. Wait for me. So, you know, when he turned 40, I don't know about y'all, but I think we're going to have a little therapy at this point. But, you know, you sort of regard you regard your life and you realize that, you know, you're sort of on a different slope. And he, things really changed for him in the mid-60s. He was he had married in 1958. He had married a woman named Frances Taylor. If you guys saw the Don Cheadle movie, that was Frances Taylor. He married her for 10 years. And then, of course, he divorced her in 1968. But that was not such a smooth relationship. It was actually rife with what we would call domestic violence at this point, and which is very troublesome. He picked up with a woman named Betty Mabry, who he married and then divorced a year later. And then he married 10 years later, Cicely Tyson, who he divorced after that. So this turmoil, this trouble of how to be an artist or a portrait of an artist as a middle-aged man, you know, how does that work for somebody? How does it work when you realize that you're trying to inspire someone and yet you realize somebody like Wayne Shorter, who is incredibly prolific and so beautiful. One of the next tunes that we'll hear is his very well-known Footprints. And he writes that, you know, he wrote Footprints when Miles asked him for something to play at gigs. You know, and for Miles to sort of give that over to someone else, and some people actually believe that's why the quintet disbanded in 1968, because Miles sort of recovered his sense of presence and said, yeah, I got it from here. And he said, I'm going to do my own thing. So I think that delicate balance of being a teacher and knowing when to lead from behind and when to lead with a charismatic feet forward is a thing that we all have to struggle with all the time.
And, you know, I don't want to carry this metaphor too much, but I would like to talk a little bit about, the same thing can be said about America. You know, you say, oh, I love America. And you're like, well, which one? You know?
Right.
And especially at this time in the 60s, you know? So how does his progression and his response to fame and to losing fame, like, how does that mirror what's happening in America at this time as well?
Well, some of you may remember more than I do the 1960s. Okay, so I may not be the best person. I've watched a lot of YouTube videos, but no, I'm just joking. But you know, the idea of, you know, 1968 when he comes out, when the quintet disbands. I mean, what happened? You know, Robert Kennedy was assassinated, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Things sort of were unraveling, and this is when he disrupted his relationships and sort of started again. So I think that there's a I don't know if it's a metaphor, but one can realize the very different kaleidoscopic ways that one could look at America, and one can see one's own self as well. And he could see this with contemporaries like Duke Ellington, who are out sponsored by the State Department, putting out the best images of America, where at home, you know, they African-American musicians had very difficult times of getting hired and being in danger of being beaten at your own gig. So the idea that, and Miles Davis did actually flirt a lot with making a pilgrimage to France. He traveled abroad a lot, and he kept coming back. And maybe that's what, just to put the metaphor here, that, you know, America always calls us home in the imperfect ways that it is and that we are too.
So I say we leave some more time for conversation, but also a lot of time for music. So what are we going to hear next?
So we're going to hear a couple more tunes. Again, these two by Wayne Shorter. We'll hear a ballad called Iris, also from the album of ESP. And as Shelley takes his solo, as Wayne sort of wrote this, I want you to hear the echoes of John Coltrane from the first quintet. And then the second tune is Footprints, as I mentioned. And this has, if you listen closely to Brannon's drumming, this really sort of put Tony Williams on the map and the understanding of substitute chords. And it actually made Wayne Shorter's name as a composer as well. So we're going to hear Iris, which is a kind of a slow tune, and a ballad, a beautiful ballad, that is from the 60s, not the 50s, and Footprints from 1966 and 1967, which is that dynamism that you've begun to hear in this beautiful quintet.
Beautiful.
So we welcome back Brannon Temple.
Woo!
Roscoe Beck. Ben Irem. Oh, by the way, Ben Irem, coming all the way from Temple, Texas, everybody. Ben, so that's pretty cool. Shelley Carroll, saxophone. David Young, trumpet.
Thank you. Thank you. Shelley Carroll on saxophone. David Young on trumpet. Ben Irem on piano. Roscoe Beck on bass. Brannon Temple on drums.